Good afternoon, everybody. Deja vu, for some of us at least. I'd like to call the Senate State Affairs Committee to order. Today is Thursday, January 28th, 2021. Let the record reflect times 3:32 p.m. Today we have present myself, Senator Schauer as the chairman. We have Vice Chair Senator Reinbold to my left, Senator Costello joining us, Senator Holland to my right, Senator Kawasaki further to the right. I would like to remind everybody, including committee members, to please silence your cell phones so that we do not have an interruption in the meeting. We all do it once in a while, so if you've helped out, that would be great. Staff that's going to assist us today. We've got Scott Ogan, Senior Policy Advisor for my office. We have Terrence Shanigan, Committee Aide for State Affairs. Kara Cooper-Ryder with Senate Records, and Kelsey and Alex behind us with the LIO. We have one item on today's agenda as we're kicking off the year. It's going to be Senate Bill 39, Ballot Custody, Tampering, Voter Registration, Mail. I will introduce the bill, read the sponsor statement, and then we will get started from there with the rest of the process. So, give me one moment. All right. From the office of Senator Mike Schauer, District E, SB 39 sponsor statement, election integrity. An act relating to elections and voter registration designating as a Class C felony the intentional opening or tampering with certain election materials and providing for an effective date. Election integrity matters. Every vote counts. Election integrity is a concern for many, which has influenced Alaskan elections for a long time. Chain of custody is the foundation of ballot integrity. SB 39 was written to allow a comprehensive look at every chain of custody issue in Alaska. The focus of the bill, which I first filed in 2019, we've been working on for over 2 years, is to ensure ballot chain of custody and election integrity. Once you lose chain of custody, you lose ballot integrity. I support mail-in voting and utilized it throughout my 24-year military career. Elections should not be called into question because of ambiguous election protocol policy. SB 39 codifies strict chain of command. There's the military side coming out. Chain of custody protocols into the handling of ballots and election reports. It mandates that all ballots be in a strict chain of custody all the way back to a central location where they can be destroyed after all ballots have been accounted for by the elections board. Current practice allows ballots to be destroyed in precinct without central accounting. SB 39 requires the director to establish in regulation best practices for chain of custody protocols and provides affected parties reasonable notice for ballot handling observation opportunities. It establishes an election office hotline number that is conspicuously posted at polling areas and on the election privacy envelopes. Every voter becomes empowered. If they see something, they can now effectively report irregularities or concerns. It requires election workers to immediately notify the director of any irregularities, then allows for an audit of ballots in precinct immediately after the election. There are no better checks and balances than empowering voters themselves at the most local level possible to become informal election observers. I want to be clear. My intent with this bill is, through rigorous debate and the committee process, to listen to all sides and make voting, including mail-in voting, more secure so Alaskans can be confident in their election system. All right. There may be some questions as we go through this, but I'm going to ask the committee members if they would, except with the exception of the sectional analysis where there may be some technical questions, which we'll certainly try to clear up, to hold their questions as we get to the end of the presentation so that we can then open it up for staff and we'll have that broader debate. At this time, I would like to go ahead and present for my office. We've got Mr. Scott Ogan, our senior policy advisor, who will present the sectional analysis, and I'm going to have staff Terrence Shanigan come up to present additional bill details and rationale.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Scott Ogan. I'm the senior policy advisor for Senator Schauer, and I've been involved in this from the beginning. Section 1 amends AS 1507.050 alpha, which eliminating automatic PFD application voter registration and providing for PFD applicant voter registration by checking a box to request registration. Section 2 amends 1507.060E as an echo to provide for PFD applicant voter registration, but only if the applicant requests to register. Section 3 amends AS 1507.070I Indigo, so the division only registers PFD applicants who request to register. Section 4, amends 15.07.070 K as in kilo to require the director to register and notify only those PFD applicants who requested to register to vote. Section 5, amends 15.07.070 I, requiring the PFD applicant request to be registered before their name is placed on the master register. Section 6 mandates a ballot security and chain of custody protocol to track ballots, absentee ballot certificates and envelopes, and paper records of electronically generated ballots, and it establishes a toll-free election defense hotline and requires a number to be placed on voting machines and election materials. Section 7 requires the director to provide election board notices with the election defense hotline. Two notices must be posted in each polling place in a conspicuous location. Section 8 amends AS 15-15-250, requiring that spoiled ballots be marked and sealed rather than destroyed. Section 9 requires that the director provide a voter notice if the voter's ballot was not counted because the voter was not a resident of the state or house district in which the voter sought to vote. Section 10 provides that elections may not be certified by the director or lieutenant governor until each original ballot is recorded and accounted for. Section 11 amends AS 15-15-470, requiring that all ballots and stubs for elections be retained for 22 months. Mandates ballot certificate and envelope destruction at a single location, witnessed by the director or their designee, and the director certification of destruction. Section 12 amends AS 15-20066 alpha to prohibit absentee voting by facsimile in state elections. Section 13 amends AS 15-20081 alpha to provide for email absentee ballot transmission. Section 14 amends AS 15-20081 D as in Delta and requires a division in the event a court invalidates the absentee ballot witness signature during an emergency declared under AS 2623 to enforce the witness signature after the emergency declaration expires. Section 15 amends AS 15-20081 ECHO to require all absentee ballots received after Election Day be postmarked on or before Election Day. Section 16 amends AS 15-20201 Bravo, requiring that reviewed absentee ballots be counted as soon as possible after reviewing and prohibiting counting delay to determine whether a voter has voted more than once in the election. Section 17 amends AS 15-20220 alpha and adds a name comparison to the review of the district county board certified absentee and question ballot votes. Section 17 amends AS 15-56035 alpha, criminalizing knowing ballot collection unless the person is collecting a single ballot and is a family member, household member, caregiver of the voter, or a person is engaged in official duties as an election official, postal worker, commercial delivery service. Basically, it prohibits ballot harvesting. Section 19 defines caregiver, collects family member, and household member in AS 15-56035. Section 20 criminalizes intentional, unauthorized opening or tampering with a sealed absentee ballot certificate or package of ballots. Section 21 requires Lieutenant Governor to notify the legislature of a security breach of affected voter registration record or voting machine. Section 22 prohibits a general law municipality, but not a home rule municipality, from making general law or special election ballot to a voter who has not affirmatively requested to vote by mail. Section 23, Amendments 43-23-015-Bravo, to allow a PFD applicant to request to be registered as a voter. Section 24 amends AS 43-23-101, so the Commissioner of Revenue is obligated to send PFD applicant information to the Division of Elections only when the applicant requests to be registered to vote. Section 25 repeals provisions authorizing the Director of the Division of Elections to conduct elections held at a time other than the general, party primary, or municipal election by mail. Section 26 provides that changes made to the PFD applications and voter registration apply to applications filled on or after the effective date of the act. Section 27 provides that the offenses enacted by the bill apply to offenses occurring on or after the effective date of the act. Section 28, transition provision authorizing the Department of Revenue and the Division of Elections to adopt regulations to implement the act. Section 29 establishes an immediate effective date for Section 28, and Section 30 establishes January 1st, 2022, effective date for the bill, except as provided in Section 29. That concludes my presentation.
All right, Mr. Hogan, thank you for that, and I'll have you on standby here as we go through other things. We may have questions. Like I said, I asked the committee if you have technical questions related to this, we can go ahead and answer those at this time. We are clearly going to talk about the philosophical and other issues of it as we go through it and answer questions. So does anybody have a question on the actual technical aspects? Senator Ramble.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Basically, Section 21, it says that notification of a security breach, as we all know, there was a pretty significant security breach, and I got a call last night. Basically where their daughter had registered it to vote and voted for the first time, and they're 18 years old, and then like a short time after they got a phone call that their personal information was violated, you know, it was a huge deal. So my question is, when does the Lieutenant Governor, because apparently he waited a considerable amount of time when they were aware of the breach from the time people were notified. So I think there needs to be a time frame in there.
Senator Rimel will certainly take a look at that. The wording currently says immediately, and I would assume immediately is within a day, 2 days, something, but certainly not 30 days or 2 months later. So we can certainly take a look at that, because sometimes intent language does not satisfy and give a time frame. So we'll certainly entertain that. And if you're looking for an amendment or some other thing, we can certainly take a look at that. So thank you for that point. Other questions on the technical aspects? This time, Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you. Yeah, in Section 2, 12, and 13, dealing with facsimile ballots, do we know how many facsimile ballots are currently received, and where do those mostly come from?
Thank you, Senator Kawasaki. We'll answer that. Is that is that a combo question for those three sections, if that makes sense?
Yeah, it all has to deal with facsimile ballots.
Okay, which one of you would like to take that?
Senator Kawasaki, to the chair, don't have that information, and we'll have to circle back.
We will provide that for you as soon as possible.
Just, I guess, on that, Mr. Chairman, I recognize that facsimile is not used very often. We don't even have one in our office. We use the neighbor's fax machine if we need it. But I guess my question is, it was my understanding that mostly overseas ballots, and particularly military, come from fax ballots, and if there's a way we can find that out. I think the last election, they recorded 131 confirmed fax ballots, but they were looking into the numbers further. So if you don't have the number, I guess we can look that up. But I'm really concerned with the military and overseas that do use fax machines.
Thank you. And the same comment would apply as to Senator Reinbold. If there's something that we need to fix or amend to make it better, we might very well do that, certainly entertain it. I would add that it was kind of interesting because this request actually came to us from a member of the House, a Democrat member of the House. So we'd have to go back and talk about why they wanted that and see. So we can certainly investigate, and we'll take that under advisement. Thank you. Other questions on the – yes, ma'am? Sorry. Yes, ma'am. Senator Costello, please.
Thank you, Senator Schauer. Section 17, I'm curious to know what
– hold on a second. Is her microphone working? It doesn't sound like she's coming across. Try it again.
Section 17, I'm curious to know what a name comparison means. Is that a signature comparison or a record of a person's name?
Senator Costello, through the chair, I believe this just as a reconciliation to make sure that the names and the absentee and question ballots reconcile. Currently, a lot of this is done by policy, and I think we have concerns that policy from time to time changes with different administrations, so we're pretty much codifying things that are currently in policy or and making sure that it's all done by statute.
Good. And I'll say more broadly to that, Senator Costello, one of the concerns we had with this is that we have been informed that policy can change. And we believe the legislature should define what it wants to see out of this and put that into statute so it's not something that can change every couple of years and becomes more fluid. So that was kind of us asserting legislative authority to say this is what we would like it to be unbounded, if that makes sense. Other questions? Okay, then we shall move on. I've got this time staff to our office, Terrence Shanigan. If you go ahead and put yourself on the record.
My name is Terrence Shanigan. I am staff to Senator Schauer.
Okay, and Terrence, I'd like you to open up, please, if you would, to talk about some of the policy protocol and precedent, what got us here, how we ended up with SB 39 and the process we've taken and the whys.
Thank you, committee, for allowing me to present to you today. I want to provide a little historical background on how we got to SB 39, since there are a lot of questions around it and maybe some misconceptions or confusion. The first thing I'd like to say is that all ballots, they are essential, they're colorblind. So they don't see things like color. And they're the great equalizer in a free society. And when we started this journey in 2019, that was sort of the genesis of this. And the thing that led us to the parent bill to this was SB 116 that was filed in 2019, was about policy, protocol, and precedent. And that's really important. We focused on policy, protocol, and precedent. And we realized that ambiguous statutes have created loose policy and taken precedent over qualitative protocol. And what Senator Schauer had mentioned just a moment ago is that when you have loose statutes and policy drives a lot of the decisions and practices within the Division of Elections, things can change between administration and administration. And that can lead to protocol that we have great disagreement about as citizens. And it can lead to things that happen right now, such as determining which votes count and which votes don't count. And if a Republican administration can decide which votes count this time, and a Democrat administration can decide which votes count next time based on policy because of an ambiguous statute, we need to figure out as a legislative body, which we want to have through rigorous debate, and not allow administrations to play politics with our vote, because for us, we felt like the integrity of that was the highest value we wanted to place on our society. We talked about things like sending people to war, spending trillions of dollars, protecting our citizens during times of pandemics, and that comes down to who we put in office. And if we lose the integrity of that, we don't trust our entire system, and it can be different than guiding ourselves by policy, and we can put it into statute because that's the authority of the legislature per the state constitution. The history of 116, SB 116, came from conversations we began in 2018, and they stemmed from a couple of significant cases that happened here in Alaska. When we came together as a team that year, we discussed the situation that happened between Senator Murkowski and challenger Joe Miller and it specifically focused on District 40. We also discussed the Ben Negiak case against Dean Westlake, which also focused on District 40. But we also focused on some ballot issues that came up during Walker Parnell that happened during recounting in Anchorage. And what we found were these just led us to understanding some things. It revealed stuff about our election. We revealed that we could destroy ballots at the precinct level. That seemed very irregular and unacceptable. We found out that the chain of custody could be broken and that not all ballots came back to a central repository, and that concerned us. We also learned that federal election laws require that in federal elections, all ballots and all materials need to be retained, and thought that's a pretty good practice. But if we're policy driving the possible destruction of ballots or permitting that at the precinct level, then how are we retaining those records? And scanned copies aren't acceptable. So this opened up the conversation to what do we have going on within this. So really this was always about, we never discussed in those early conversations and had concern about mail-in voting, except that we knew that there were a small percentage of votes that were actually mail in and absentee. We believed that SB 116 standing on its own last session was going to have a good chance of making it through the legislature and becoming law. And we felt like SB 116 could clean up a significant amount of the ambiguous policy-driven items within the statute and allow us to actually set some things concretely in stone and standardize them statewide. What happened, though, when COVID hit and we stopped having hearings on our bills, SB 116 was doomed at that point. The immediate feeling in our office was that we had started to talk about how SB 116 was going to make the situation of all the mail-in voting that we were anticipating through COVID was going to be a non-factor. But when 116 did not pass, the concern was we knew that there was a certain level of error in mail-in voting in general and in some of these statutes. When you put a 10 times multiplier on that and go from 20,000 votes to 200,000 votes, you start to swing elections in ways that you never intended. And along those lines, what ended up happening was that we said, okay, if Section 25 specifically addresses the issue of mail-in voting, if we don't, and it was inserted as a place to talk about, if we don't clean up the ambiguous language and put some codifying language in that protects the integrity of the ballots and puts chain of custody situations, protocols in place, if we don't do that, we need to seriously consider looking at our mail-in voting system and having the debate whether or not we can afford to keep it because there are certain situations. That leads us to chain of custody. As a former state trooper, chain of custody and evidence is extremely important. We track it with paper, with signatures, with multiple viewers. There's special tape, there's dates. And when you break a label or break that chain of custody, that evidence is oftentimes contaminated, no longer admissible, or faces serious legal challenges. You saw it in the O.J. Simpson trial, where one police officer takes evidence, puts it in his trunk, and takes it home. And maybe he never opened that box, never saw it, never unlocked his trunk. But because there was a question in the integrity of the evidence, the chain of custody was broken, that evidence faced serious legal challenges and essentially became a cornerstone of one of the things that eroded that trial. So when we looked at figuring out how to address the chain of custody, we knew that we needed to track ballot integrity. When you vote in person, one of the things that we recognized was that the chain of custody is very tight. It's not perfect, but it's strong. You have a ballot that starts at Division of Elections. It remains secure until it reaches its precinct point. It remains secure with people watching it the entire time. Then that ballot goes into the hand of a person that's come in that's been verified visually and usually with an identification and a signature. And that person is watched going to a booth, not being interfered with by anyone else. They step out of that booth. Once they have left that booth, they put that ballot themselves into another locked machine which takes it in, and it isn't unlocked from that chain of custody until the time that it's counted and tabulated and it's witnessed by multiple people. That is a secure chain of custody. that is the opposite of what we have right now with mail-in voting in Alaska. There are mail-in voting systems in other states that are different than ours, but in ours, you have a mail-in voting system that's problematic in a number of ways. Number one is you have a ballot that, once it enters the U.S. Postal Service, is disappearing for an unknown amount of time, contacted by unknown people, and it's uncertain where it's going. And then it shows up at your house days or weeks later. You complete that ballot and put it back into this lack of chain of custody, and it goes through the same process of all these unknowns and ends up back at the Division of Elections. Now, in itself, that's a problem. But it becomes more of a problem when you have a data breach where 113,000 records are now lost, and that data can sometimes be compromised. It's further complicated when you have citizens that are receiving more than one ballot. And in Alaska, right now, our office talked to many, many people that received ballots, more than one ballot. And at first, we thought, well, this is just, it's just certain areas. But they were coming in from all districts of the state to our office, not one or two, all districts of the state. And it tells us that our data, our own data that we have, there's something wrong with it. We don't know what's wrong. Why are some people getting five ballots? Why do some get one? We do know that there's some problematic areas within that ballot sequence, though. We do know the 113,000 records are compromised. If we do nothing today, we have to still reinvent our system, because we have 113,000 records that potentially could still create an error. We know that ballots can still be, by policy, destroyed at a precinct level. That's a concern. But when you add the factor that municipalities are allowing people to vote with mail-in, and the same person that gets five ballots at the state level election reported to us that they received five ballots at the municipal election. So when we're told by the Division of Elections that the system is clean and it's not our problem, it's happening somewhere else, well, the municipalities like Anchorage are taking their data from the state system and then using that to go out. So they're trusting the data in the system. And we've now replicated the problem to a municipal entity. And there are some ways to fix that. You can completely start your data over and re-register everybody, but we need to figure out how to clean that information up. Another complicating factor is the auto enrollment feature inside of the dividend. We believe that it should be easy for people to enroll and vote, but we should make sure that it's not forcing people to do something they don't want to do. I personally don't want the system enrolling me without my acknowledgement or without my choice. What we saw and what we have evidence of, we have, for example, a foreign national. That person came to Alaska. They're here legally. They have a family member that's here. That's a citizen. They were here for a year, not a citizen, but they were applied to receive services from the state, as some people need. In that case, that person applied for help through the state. They met the time requirement and could apply. They applied for a permanent fund dividend. But because they weren't eligible for the dividend, they were denied. Automatic enrollment to become a citizen or to become into the voter system, they're enrolled to be a voter, and now they receive a ballot to vote in this last election. When you have those kinds of anomalies happening, and it's hard not to start to wonder how much integrity we've lost in the system. And one of the things that we've done with this bill is we've said, okay, how do we do this? We met with people on both sides of the aisle, with groups, all sorts of them that opposed, that supported mail-in voting and voter roll registration, like through the PFD. We think that's a good idea. It's an easy way for people, when you go to the DMV or you go to the PFD, that you can do that, but it should be your choice. So in the current process, when you apply for your PFD, it says, hey, you've been enrolled in, this is the address we're going to use, and you're now registered to vote. We're saying that same little message comes up, but you get to check a box that says, do you want us to change this address or don't you? It's the same thing. It's a simple change. And now you have a choice. And in a free society, we should be about choices on certain things like that. We should be given that opportunity if you don't want to be foisted into a system. And one of the problems it's creating is, what if your PFD address happens not to be your voting address? And that happens for many rural Alaskans. My family is Alaska Native. I understand the importance of mail-in voting. We also understood the significance of the need because of geography, because of distance, because of resources, because there aren't reliable resources to have poll workers or people interested in doing it in some places, and that was a huge cornerstone of our conversation. Me and three other people that were part of an Alaska Native think tank talking about the challenges we faced in rural Alaska with voting and how important mail-in voting and absentee voting can be. So for us, that was a big part of the conversation, but those can be exceptions here, that we understand how to make exceptions without hurting the whole system. We believe that there's a better way of doing this. We have to have the ability to authenticate our information. The financial world here uses authentication to determine who you are. And there are places that vote that use authentication. Even signatures can be tampered with. And if we have people breaching our systems, we don't want our signatures floating around. You don't want your Social Security number floating around. So you create a system that has multi ways of authenticating you as a voter, and you still get the vote. And I believe that we are going to find a way that most people are going to really be interested in mail or not in-person voting with all of the things that we face because of a different way of authenticating who we are when we vote that can be verified. But first, we have to have statutes that clean up the mess that we have. We have to understand and be honest with what we've got. We've got a system where our data is corrupted and it's exposed. And if we do nothing about it, we're setting ourselves up for big failure. This bill was never about stopping mail-in voting. You can go back to SB 116, that was never in the bill. We put it in there because we felt there is a grave danger to the integrity of our system here in Alaska. It has nothing to do with anywhere else. We proved that because we've been working on this. And it's been something that we were studying cases, Alaskan cases. And when we started to go back and look at those things, we said, look, there are a lot of small things we can do to make the system tighter, better, and protective. You're going to see that all of this stuff that puts this around race is dismissive of all of the people that I know, my family, that have concerns about what goes on in my village. You don't have to dismiss us. It is not a race issue. Ballots don't see color. They see integrity. And by putting the conversation on the table that if we do nothing, we should seriously consider the mail-in concerns, I guess I will just leave it at that.
So, Terrence, thank you for that. I thought it was important that we get some background out because there's been quite a few misconceptions that have been thrown around from various either people, organizations, and even in some of the media. So what I want to do as part of this conversation is make sure that we get that out front of it because the cart was put in front of the horse and we were answering questions before we even had the first hearing on that. And so it's put us into a position where we're having to explain to people that it doesn't do what people have said it does. And that's part of the intent here so that people can see this, come to this meeting if they want to watch it or review it later and understand it. If they don't agree with it in the end, that's totally fine. We have a civil debate about it. But you know the way I operate, and that's part of this for the committee to understand, is I believe in putting all options on the table. This is a statewide bill. It affects many places, so we should all have this debate. Ultimately, the ideas will sink or swim on their own. This bill will likely change through the amendment process and committees and debates, and so be it, and that's fine. We have no ownership in that particular thing other than to make this better. I want to highlight a couple things and either have yourself or Mr. Ogan discuss them. One of the things I think is important in addition to how we put some of the things and why. And I'll go back to the PFD, for example. The PFD was put in there, but if you remember when it passed in 2016, a third of the state voted against it. And I've had a number of people reach out to us, as the office can attest to, and tell us we don't want that. Now, you've explained how a lot of people don't want to be put into that boat if they want to be eligible and request a PFD but not be forced into the voting system. I have an area that's pretty, for lack of a better term, they don't want a lot of government interference in their lives, and they don't want to be automatically registered. So the point becomes, one of the reasons of putting this in is to have the debate and go, can we find a reasonable compromise? People can still select that, but if they don't want that, it's not forced upon them. For example, they still have a choice. Talking about no mail-in, there is a section of this state, quite a big section actually, that doesn't want mail-in at all. There are sections of the state that want nothing but mail-in. I think we would find a majority of Alaskans probably don't mind where it is now as long as it is secure. We're trying to identify those areas where it's not secure, where we can make it better. But I would imagine most Alaskans would like the option to be able to vote in person. I would imagine a lot of Alaskans still also want the option to vote absentee, either because they want to, they need to, they're in a rural area, they're in the military, you name it. No intent to stop that. Like I said, I've used it myself many times. So the last one is I'll have you talk to this, but I want to throw that out there because that was also the intent of this, not just the things we saw, but we are getting requests from citizens from multiple sides of the equation. And we believe everybody should have a chance to discuss these things and figure out the best way forward. So part of this is to allow the debate and to get all these things out there so that we can discuss them and see, right? So that's important that I think we say that because, again, I've heard a lot of myths, and I would even call some of them flat-out falsehoods, you know, that this eliminates mail-in voting, eliminates local control by prohibiting mail-in voting at the municipal level, no longer allows registration through PFD, like no longer allows it, right, cancels it, prevent people from registering to vote, eliminating the option for mail-in voting via absentee ballots, limits rural participation in voting. You talked about towards the end being a native Alaskan and what that means. And so I want people to understand that from an intent perspective of filing this bill and what we put into it is to have the discussion. We have no intent to do those things, and I hope people will see through this discussion and debate process and what we're talking about today that that's not where we're going with this bill. It was never the intention. Even as you said, that if we get to a point where we find that we're unable to secure our voting system, then maybe we need to have the discussion about mail-in. How do we do it better if we can't? Last thing I would like you to comment on, and I'll see if there's any others before we open it up for questions. I think we're pretty close to finishing our presentation because this has become so contentious so quickly, I really felt that we needed to take the time to discuss it, is the possibility of fraud versus error. Because that has come up a lot, and a lot of people said fraud. Well, we see fraud. We think there are cases of fraud or the potential for fraud. We certainly saw that in our investigation, as we've talked to a number of citizens that reached out to our office. But that's not the only thing we're discussing here. In fact, it may be the smallest part of it. We certainly don't want to open up the possibility for fraud, but one of the things we have seen through this investigative process is the possibility of error. And so can you just briefly highlight again the difference between fraud and error so that people understand what we're discussing between those two issues and how they affect this overall system?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, I'll highlight the one part here that I think wanted to do a comparison. If we were to go to our, if we were to use the same level of protocol integrity for our in-voting system right now, compare it to our mailing system, we would have unmanned precincts, and you would lay the votes envelopes on tables, and people would come in, and they would do what they're going to do inside the voting booth there, and there'd be a sign that says only take one, and then they would leave. And you'd leave it for somebody else to handle and touch and do whatever until someone came back 8 hours later. That's unacceptable. When we think about it in terms of in-person voting, we should think about this unless you have authentication, a way to authenticate. And it wouldn't matter if someone took your ballot, and there is a way to do it. And fraud versus error. Our process almost exclusively focused on error, the error rate. You know, when we redraw boundary lines, one of the biggest things that came up through the Walker-Parnell election was this thing that we found out that was an extremely high error rate in what people think the district they think they're registered in and the district they actually are registered in. You may have never moved, but boundary lines get redrawn. Sometimes you have an address through PFD that's someplace else. You're in this place and you go to vote, and then all of a sudden your ballot gets questioned and your vote for your local representative doesn't count. And at that time, in those races that we were looking at that where people had votes questioned and then their actual their statewide votes counted, but their district votes didn't count, weren't counted, because there was an inconsistency based on them moving. Someone had lived in a city for 18 or 20 years, but a lot of things changed, and they always thought, why would I need to register from Kotzebue if I live in Anchorage now? And they just keep voting, and no one is telling them, no one is notifying them. And one of the things we thought, it's really darn important for the Division of Elections to notify, not by policy, they were willing to do it by policy, but when the next administration comes in or somebody decides it's a headache or they're not getting a letter, I should know as an Alaskan when my vote doesn't count in any race, when it's been questioned. Another policy-driven thing that we're getting at here is, if you vote absentee, or if you vote, or if you request an absentee ballot, let's just say you vote an absentee ballot, and you mail it in, been busy year, you get confused, nothing malicious, election day comes, and you go, I want to vote in person. And so you show up at the ballot box, and there's confusion at the ballot box. This happened in at least five precincts that we know of, and it happened multiple times where errors happen. Now, sometimes you're given the correct ballot, and what we think is the correct ballot, and you we've had inconsistent information. Division of Elections has said they're not sure, they don't, you can't tell when you look at a roll whether somebody is an absentee or not. But what we're finding out from poll workers is that, yes, you can tell if someone's got an absentee ballot. So we've got to get to the bottom of that. But if they give you a general ballot, and they go in, and if they catch both ballots, if they catch them, we don't know that they can right now, because they can't catch the ballots going out. We don't know that they can stop them coming in. If they catch both ballots, let's say if you vote a general ballot, you get that one gets to count because you fed it into a machine when you were there. The absentee ballot, if they catch it, doesn't count. If they don't, it counts. So potentially, they could one is not going to count, and you get one or you get two that go for it. But if they give you a question ballot at that location, it neutralizes both out. And who makes that choice? Well, if it's a Republican governor, that administration. And if it's a Democrat governor, that administration. They can change that. And I think, as Alaskans, we should be concerned about administrations choosing whose vote they're going to count and whose they're not. We're going to have, it's muddy. And we aren't lining that stuff out. And, you know, I've been on this election stuff for a long time trying to figure out how do we clean the system up. That's a real easy way to do it. And we have had a lot of conversations with the Division of Elections over the last several months, trying to get answers to this, trying to figure out what's driving it. How do we make changes, propose some of these things statutorily? But we understand that it's our responsibility here, which is why we're taking such an aggressive stance against this, putting these strict protocols in. Let's bring this back to zero. Let's figure out how to clean up our voter rolls. And then we don't have questions about why we should or should not have mail-in voting, because I don't think that even matters, whether or not we should be comparing signatures. That, to me, is not, that's a moot point when you have authentication, a multi-factor way of authenticating signatures. And the fraud and the error, when we looked at a pie, we shared it with a couple of people this week. When we look at the pie of stuff that we're working with, the problems within our election system, the smallest sliver, probably 3 or 4% of it, was fraud. The rest of it is errors. We have an error-ridden system, and it's because of loose statutes leading to ambiguous policy, and then we start setting protocols based on that, and we can't do that anymore. We really need a task force. We need citizens involved. And we need to push this down to the most local level possible. And I think one area we didn't touch on was Section 22. And Section 22 was about municipalities. And the reason why that was placed in there is our office has always believed in pushing everything to the most local level possible. I, as an Alaska Native, I want public safety to the most local level possible. And it isn't right now. We offer our troopers to come out of urban hubs, and they go into rural areas. And that system, when you have a system like that where it's hub and spoke, you lead to poor performance or reduced performance in what you're trying to get to, because it costs a lot. You have distance, geography, you have time and expenses. You see it in education. The same element happens. Education in rural areas, it's hard to get those resources out there. You're doing it from another location, and you deal with geography, weather, time, cost. When you deal with elections, you have the same pieces. You want it at the most local level possible. Section 22 addressed that. It said, if you are a municipality or a borough, it could probably have been changed to say if you are any entity that wants to self-govern, but it was addressing if you already are doing your own voting, like Anchorage or Juneau. They have their own ordinances that guide their own policy. You're exempt from a lot of this stuff. If you're an aspiring community and you want to opt out of the state's restrictions and do your own governance at the most local level possible, you can opt out. And we were trying to say that you have to understand, we were trying to be clear that if you're already doing something or want to do something, this system's for you. And all the others, it applies to you. If it didn't apply to you, what would apply to you? It certainly wouldn't be a government from another country's election system. So it has to be, And people were asking us questions in 116. Well, what do we do if we don't have our own ordinances? Well, then the state system applies to you. And that's what 22 was saying. And it left it open for people, for communities to opt out of the state system and create their own local system. And it's been our principal driving force is getting things to the most local level possible.
Talk about the protocol, though, for a protocol of that for the security side versus local municipal elections, because that's part of that, as we discussed it.
So
having a protocol that they still need to follow that would ensure this ballot, the election integrity.
Yes.
But not trying to stop them from having their own mail-in voting.
So
make it clear.
Correct. So if you set it up at the very highest level, you set standards of protocol, and you don't direct. If you don't direct them a specific method or a particular tool to use, and you just say, for example, we want you to use a an approved, federally or state-approved multi-factor authentication system. You're not saying I want you to use Facebook to go authenticate or North Rim Bank. You're not directing them what they can do. There are so many ways to do that to authenticate, and you allow those communities to design a system. If we say that, if we set certain standards that apply to everyone so that we have a baseline throughout, and one really good example right now is Senator Elvie Gray Jackson has a bill out. And I don't know the Senate bill number, but it applies to police reporting of certain types of use of force, okay? The Anchorage Police Department and the Alaska State Troopers do that by policy right now. And maybe little departments do their own policies. But if you want to standardize that across the state, you're not telling them how to do it, you're telling them what they need to do. And if you standardize it, everybody's operating from the same baseline. Now they can apply that in the way that fits their organization or their community. We need to look at doing that in elections, that we create a baseline that's standard, and as communities pull out and want to function and do them themselves in a method that fits their community, they still adhere to the same standard, like ISO standards. You can make the inner workings of the plug that goes into the wall any way you want, as long as it meets the standards, so that it doesn't short out your cell phone. And we lack that right now in our election system, and we need to create more definition and define it. I think this is our opportunity right now, that we could lead Alaska on elections reform, and we could do this the right way. And there's a lot of people involved right now, I think, on both sides, that are very emotional about this issue, and I think that's a positive thing, because we know people are interested. And it tells me that a large part of our population does care about their vote. And
Mr. Chairman?
Okay, stand by 1 second. Go ahead, Mr. Rogan.
Yeah, I'd like to interject something in the discussion, if I may.
If you can hold that thought for 1 second, I'm going to ask one last question of Mr. Shanigan and have him finish, and I was going to go to you anyway, so thank you, because I do want to wrap this up, our portion, so we reserve time for folks to start getting into the debate and the questions. As fast as possible, so not necessarily yes or no, but quick, the things I listed as far as, like, the myths that have been spread about this and what our intent is and other things, do the solutions you see we're searching after in SB 39 for the issues of where we believe we have weakness for the potential for fraud and error, et cetera, to the problems that we've identified throughout this, do you see this, and I'm going to ask you as an Alaskan native, as a veteran, as a lifelong Alaskan, same question for myself, et cetera, do you see any part of this bill based on our intent and what we are trying to accomplish as voter suppression?
No, because we can still, tomorrow, if this bill passed in its form tomorrow, I believe we would still have exceptions to be able to absentee vote and do all of those things. I think we'd have to examine some of the areas, like you're raising the question about the facsimile. I think that would probably be something we need to do. But I don't see how this suppresses a vote. We voted in person for 247 years, and to think that all of a sudden, because of technology and mail, we can't vote, that if we took that away, our society would crumble and we'd be suppressing people is ridiculous, because there are still going to have to be these exceptions that we have in our current system. What did we do before a couple years ago when we did the mass mail-out voting? I know that we have concerns about things like COVID. We have systems and protocol for that. But no one has presented. No one's called the office. I answer the phones and receive hundreds of emails and stuff so far about this and talked to so many people. Nobody is presenting to me questions about what were you thinking here? What's your thought process behind that? Hey, I got a better way of doing it. If they're for it, they're for it. If they're against it, they're against it. I just don't see the where it suppresses people, because if you could vote in person before, you can vote in person now. If you had to have an absentee situation before, you'd have the absentee situation now. So I guess that argument needs to be had, and I want to hear what people say. Why is it suppressing? Because I'm not hearing the why. I'm just hearing it will, and it's a charged statement. If you think that it is doing it, explain to me how it is and how many people it would affect when it does do that. If anything, sometimes protocols and red tape can slow things down, but I want to know how it stops them. And because we have been so emotionally invested in this ourselves, I just want to see that, even answers for myself. How does it stop you from voting and limit you? If you have a medical condition, if you can't go out, if you have a geographic limitation, bring that to us. We'll figure out, did it exist before this, and would it exist after it, and how did we solve it then, and how might we bridge that now? That's why that discussion is really important to have.
Thank you. Going to open up Mr. Ogan, if you can give us a couple minutes so that we can get to questions, please. Thank you.
I'll wrap this up quickly. I'd just like to comment on voter suppression. When you have a system that is ripe with errors and possible fraud, that is a form of voter suppression, because a fraudulent vote or a mistake suppresses a valid voter.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Ogan. If you'd stay on the phone for now, we're going to jump into questions. And what I'm going to try to do is be fair about this and just go around, and I would ask you to ask your question. A follow-up is certainly fine, standard protocol here, but I'd like to make sure everybody has a chance to go through this, because this is going to be charged. We've already seen that plenty in the last 5 or 6 days. So we'll just start off, and off we go. So at this point, questions. I know there's going to be plenty, so who wants to go first?
I'll go first.
Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I understand are we talking about policy, internal policy, or are we talking about regulations that are established through the Division of Elections?
I think
just a technical question.
To the chair, Senator Kawasaki, we're talking about in some cases where there isn't anything codified guiding policy, where policy sometimes is learned along the way. Sometimes it's good policy, and sometimes it's that maybe isn't being evenly applied, or that there is ambiguity even in that policy. It's not specific enough, where policy may even drive the error. And so in some cases, we're saying we need to put some regulation in there, something codified. But when you have situations like destroying ballots at the precinct level, or choosing which ballots you're going to destroy and not count when somebody votes, and that isn't in codified statutory language. That's a policy that drives it. And depending on who your director of elections are or who your governor is, that can change. That doesn't create a system that you can trust. That creates a system that is completely political. And just as easy as those regulations can be create red tape, we need to make sure that we're looking at both sides of that.
Follow up, I know.
So I think we're getting confused about what the regulation is and whether it's just this is the best practice. We want you to dress appropriately at the precinct. That's not a regulation, but it's sort of what they give in the handbook for people who are directing traffic at the polling location. So I think a lot of these are already currently in regulations, and I probably would want to have a more deeper analysis of what's not in regulation. To understand what exactly we're changing and if we're changing something that's in regulation or not. Secondly, so you keep mentioning things that have changed.
Senator Costa, I think Scott wanted to, or sorry, Mr. Ogan would like to have a follow-up answer. I can hear him in the background. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Kawasaki. For example, we spoke with Division of Elections last year. They told us when somebody votes twice, their vote is canceled. This year, they said when they vote twice, their last vote counts. So there's an example. Also, I have 10 years of experience working in the administration, and I can't tell you how many meetings I was in with people within the agency I worked in that I would sit there and go, that's not what the regulation says. That's not what the statute says. And I can't tell you how many times they've said, well, yeah, I know, but this is the way we've always done it. And I go, well, that's not going to hold up if you get, you know, appealed or litigated. Yeah, well, we're not going to worry about that. And I had the same thing. I had federal government do the same thing in the CFRs. And what I did is I managed a team of litigants, of attorneys that litigated against the United States. And I would sit there in those meetings with those federal bureaucrats and say, that's not what the CFRs say. Oh, no, we know what it says. We know how to interpret it. And I go, we're going to sue you. Well, okay, go ahead. And I won every single case, 13, 14, 15 cases. And finally, they started reading their CFR. So just because it's in a statute, even a statute or regulation, doesn't mean that the bureaucrats are going to follow it. What it does, it gives you a process that you can hopefully take to an objective court and alter their behavior.
Thank you, Mr. Ogren. Senator Karasek, I know you had a second question, and then I'm going to try to see who else would like one.
Yeah, I've got a lot of questions, but let me just – so we were talking about basically that things can change from administration. What's changed between the Parnell-Walker administration and Walker to Dunleavy?
We have to go and look. We've requested that information, haven't received that yet, but we were confirmed that when we specifically asked the question so what vote counts can change from administration to administration, and that information back to us was yes, just like this time. So we know that that can happen and does happen, and we know that it's been confirmed by the current administration. So we don't know how it's changed because we have requested the policy changes. We should seek policy changes from administration to administration to see, but when you have ambiguous statute, it leads to loose policy. And that's the point of having good policy, or a good policy driven by solid protocols that are codified in statute, that are clarified. A lot of this is clarifying things and including things that are making it an ambiguous, because if we put policy as precedent that we have right now, not based on really good regulation, codifying language, then we're opening this system up, and that's the problem that we're trying to get to. It is not clear. Our system is left very loose right now. And there may be some things that look clear we should examine, because I think what you're getting at is we should have that discussion, and it needs to be rigorous. And I don't have that information in front of me, but we should have it, and we should look at it as a committee.
I'm going to just keep moving, but you're getting plenty of chance, Senator Kavasak. I'm not going to shut you off. So, because this is part of why we're doing this, I want to have this debate and get it out on the open or in the open. I would want to add to that answer, though, that we go all the way back, because like I said, we've been working on this for really 3 years. And if you go back before the primary, we were working with another Democrat office inside the legislature as well that had seen some irregularities as we did. And without throwing her into the bus and getting myself in too much trouble, my wife works at a poll, and we had a poll director reach out to us and talk about irregularities that they have seen in the entire process. And so we started asking questions all the way from the primary back at this last August that we had a hard time getting answers to. So there's a number of things that have been difficult for us to find the answers for whatever the reasons are, but we're not quite getting them. And then once you got to the general and the other things that took place, and then we found out about the data breach, et cetera, we've been asking questions, but lawsuits were filed, and they haven't talked to us. So I know there's kind of a gag order as we've gone through some of that, so there's been delays. All that to say that we have been working on this and trying to get answers for the better part of half a year and have not gotten many. When we get them, you will get them for the same reason.
So, Mr. Chairman, just a request for you then.
Sure.
I would love to have the lieutenant governor who administers elections, as well as the division director for the Division of Elections, come before us so that they can testify to some of these, some of the issues, potential election integrity issues.
We have a long list. I have every intention of getting as many of those people as we can for the debate. I will tell you, I was told that the governor, lieutenant governor, would not come before the legislature, so we'll probably not get him. So just FYI. So,
Mr. Chairman.
So we're going to move on. Mr. Ogden, go ahead. Was there a specific point?
I'd just like to throw something into the mix. You know, when you have ambiguous statutes and ambiguous regulations and policy, and then you're dealing with mostly a large volunteer organization of civic-minded folks that dedicate their time to come and help oversee these elections, and then when not a lot of money to train them, and maybe not a lot of experienced people. That system in itself begs to be very clear, very unambiguous, and follow the textbook. And if it's left up to individual precincts, well, okay, let's destroy these ballots, or maybe not, or, you know, or possibly even, God forbid, somebody actually says, you know what, I really don't like this one candidate. We have 100 extra ballots here in our village. Let's Only 70 people voted. Let's throw those ballots out and re-vote. And if you don't have those chain of custody protocols, God forbid, I'm not accusing anybody of anything. Please don't take that like because I said village. I live in a village in Saldovia, okay? And I'm not accusing anybody of anything. But if that did happen, I mean, that situation is ripe to happen. And we hope and pray that everybody that is doing this is doing it with integrity. But, you know, liars figure and figures lie.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Ogan. Okay, we'll go to other members for the moment. Trying to limit it to roughly two as we work around the table. So who else? Okay. Senator Rambel.
Thank you. So speaking of the lieutenant governor, I think it would be great to have him before the committee. I mean, he's been in this body, and he has the ultimate responsibility in regards to, overseeing the election. So I definitely would concur with inviting him. And then I'd like, in regards to the Dominion voting systems, definitely a hearing, in regards to them, because that definitely is created concerns across the state, and I don't know if they're valid or invalid, but I think that it is something that's really important that we look into. And also there's been a lot of people saying that there was concerns and whether they have an opportunity to present, their issues before the committee in regards to some of the concerns that are being raised throughout the state and even potentially as a nationwide, the other states that had Dominion voting systems, I mean, just even potentially having them come before us and show that there really are some serious things that at least need to be looked at, potentially audited, because I think faith in our elections is so important. It's the foundation of a republic. And so I just think it's super, super important. So with that, I want to say thank you for at least trying to open up. I know it's hard to open up a can of worms like this, but I think it's super important, and I really wanted to say thank you, and I look forward to working with you on this.
Thank you. And for Senator Rambel, Senator Kawasaki, the rest of the committee, we have a list of people we're trying to bring in. If there is a request, give it to us, and we'll try to bring them in. Whoever they are, we'll do our best to get them if they're available and put them before the committee if they're willing to come testify or able to. And I want to say one more thing as we go to the next question, whoever has it, about the partisan side of this, because this has become partisan very quickly, at least kind of in the media and social media, et cetera. And I would tell you, you could go back to 2016 and see one half of the country that was, making, accusations of, election fraud and all kinds of stuff going on, and people were angry. Well, you could say the same now on the other side of the aisle. Another part of the country is angry about this. So what I'm trying to say is that this is not an issue that goes to a partisan side. Everybody can make a claim about things that didn't happen for their candidate, their guy, their side. The intent is, I think you can find that there is generally a shaken confidence in our election system. I don't care necessarily about what's happened nationally. That's not the intent here. Like I said, we've been working on this for years. What I want to do, what our intent is to find a way to try to restore faith of Alaskan citizens in our election system, however we can. And there's certainly room for improvement. There always is, and that's the intent. But I just want to highlight that because you can say that on both sides of the aisle when your team loses, whatever, right? So anyways, moving on to next questions. Senator Costello.
Thank you. And I do want to thank the chair for shining a light on integrity of elections, because I do know that it matters. It matters to me, and it matters to all my constituents. So I want to thank you for posing the question. I do have a request. I'm asking that we take the sectional and expand it. I would like to know for each section of the bill, what is the problem being solved by that section? Is it a problem that might happen, or is it a problem that has happened? And if it is solving a problem that has in fact occurred, I would like to have a specific example. And I'll actually provide you an example. Personally, I have been approached by constituents who, during an election, they are surprised to find out that their voter registration, the address of their registration, has changed. It changed when they applied for a permanent fund dividend, and they're surprised that they can't vote in the election where they live because they applied for a dividend where they worked. Perhaps it was on the North Slope. So in that section, what you would say is, this is the problem that's being solved. and it has happened, and this is an example. So some of these, I don't have examples to apply to them, but I would like your staff to go back and provide that information for the committee, and I do think that the public would appreciate that also. So thank you.
Sure. Do you have any other questions at the moment?
No.
Okay, thank you. And we do have quite a few of those. Like I said, almost everything in this bill, well, I can really say everything in one broader sense, has been expressed from one group or another, or constituents, or other legislators. So we have taken this hodgepodge and tried to bring it into a big bill that that really affects various groups across the state. So we will do our best to try to limit that, because some of those that would get really big, but we will identify the specific problem area with maybe a few examples or one or two or something to that effect, so that you can see that and use it. And you're right, that would be helpful. So we will absolutely do that, and we'll try to get that out inside the next week, however long it takes us to do that. Thank you. Senator Holland.
I just echo Senator Kawasaki's thoughts about getting the point of view from the Division of Elections and getting someone from there and here looking at it. And I probably missed my opportunity for the technical review, but I'd have questions about it's a little hard to comprehend Section 18, and the last part of that is around line 21, 22, 23, where it talks about possessing only one other voter's ballot. And I'm sure what you're intending is getting one ballot from that person, but are we limiting, like, a family member from collecting one ballot?
So I'm going to have Mr. Ogan answer that as the drafter with the Ledge legal team. However, that is essentially, we're talking about ballot harvesting to try to prevent, you know, people from canvassing and just grabbing as many as they can get. Many other states in our research we found either limited it or had outlawed it, depending on that. We don't want to restrict that necessarily, because you could, for example, one of the examples given was you might have an elderly family member you're caring for and they can't go to the poll, hard time getting an absentee ballot, and you would take that for them so that they could make sure their vote gets cast, so they're not excluded from the process. So there are things that we would have to go through this debate to find out what exemptions might we need, or what would make sense for a number. But the intent behind it is to look at having people that are paid to come up here and go canvassing, scooping as many ballots as they can get through neighborhoods. This was kind of the initial intent to look at this and open up the discussion, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. But Mr. Ogan, if you can give us a little more on the sectional analysis for Senator Holland, please.
Yeah, well, it's definitely, I think you covered most of it. You know, I don't know about the rest of you political junkies, but sometimes I go through the garbage can in the post office during election season just to see, you know, what everybody is mailing out, right? And during election, possibly there's like a mail-out ballot election that a municipality is holding. How many ballots are in the trash cans that some astute person with nefarious intent could pull out? We also found, we talked to people that got ballots they didn't ask for. We talked to a lot of people that got ballots they didn't ask for, and we were very, very specific drilling in. Did you get ballots or did you get ballot applications? Because a lot of candidates send applications to people, you know, encouraging them to vote absentee, right? And virtually everybody said ballots. Well, he said, do you still have them? Well, no. But after they got these mysterious ballots they didn't ask for, we talked to several people that had people come by and knock on their doors and ask for their absentee ballot. So, you know, that was a data breach. You know, was there a connection? You know, we don't know. But it's plausible there's a connection. So that whole section there, if it needs work to make sure that people that are infirmed or can't get around, there aren't ambulatory or any other number of reasons, we're all about it. We want to stop the professional ballot harvesting that we know with reasonable certainty what's going on in the last election, and it's probably gone on for quite a while.
Thank you, Mr. Ogan. Mr. Shannon.
This just kind of goes somewhat to the ballot harvesting, but when we had this discussion, we were looking at a bill that's over in the House, that's been filed in the House. It talks about pre-stamped envelopes. That's something we didn't include here, but that's caused a discussion over the last week. And a lot of these pre-stamped envelopes might get a postage mark, but they don't get a date stamp. And ballot harvesting, if you go to an election night, you get 15-day window, which this bill kind of addresses, we're trying to address between this and if you have a large window after the vote is taken, you're 3 days later, you're losing. Ballot harvesters, either they've previously harvested, they go out harvest, or they go door to door and say, hey, have you mailed it in yet? If you have pre-stamped envelopes, that's adding more ambiguity to a mail-in system. We cannot permit stuff like that. We can't keep creating ways to decrease the integrity. And so as you hear about this stuff, the ballot harvesting is a big issue. This election cycle, it sounds like companies just go out and do that. My own personal experience with it, it doesn't happen in Alaska, false. I worked for the Tony Knowles campaign. They brought up 250 people to do that, to go door to door. I sat in the training sessions with them. And, you know, it wasn't illegal, so people were out doing that. But you know what? It opens up an opportunity when you have people, not even from our state, going door to door in our communities, looking through things. There's opportunity there. So we got to be careful. I've experienced it. I sat in the trainings. I've been in those things. And on campaigns, we all know. And so we just have to figure out a better way to do it.
Thank you. And that's probably, Senator Holland, a little more than you wanted on that one. But I'm going to add a couple, two real quick anecdotes here. One, it's unfortunate that we had the delay in announcing the data breach, because it was known almost a week before the general election. And I wish that they would have said something to the public, because I think what you would have found is people would have been on guard. They would have been paying attention to it. They might have taken pictures of the extra ballot, something that would have given us evidence. But what do most people do? They get four ballots. They send in one. If they're honest, they go, they toss them in the garbage. Some of them take them into the polling station. They take them for them, do what they do. So it was unfortunate that we did not have that with the ability for citizens to be a little more respondent or paying attention to what happened. So one of the issues we kind of had with that delay in announcing it until a month after the election. The other thing is, I can tell you somebody that told me in the last 2 days, somebody inside this building that works here, that said, thank you for doing this. The reason being, because they have kids in their house, and said that they got ballots. And if that person had been dishonest, that he could have easily, or she could have easily, just turned those ballots in if they wanted to. But they were honest and said, I can't do that. So the point is, as we discussed this even in a meeting the other day with some folks from Juneau, we were told they sent out 27,000 ballots in a municipal election. There's about 32,000 people here, and they were making the joke, well, there must be a lot of five-year-olds voting. So there is room, folks, to improve the system. So long answer there, Senator Holland. Sorry, but do you have a follow-up or a second question?
No, thank you.
Okay, we're going to go back to Senator Kawasaki, because I know you're over there antsy for more questions.
I am. You know, I just want to start by saying that, you know, we've had a lot of assertions that there's this fraud going on. And we've had statements made that there could be something happening, or there may be something happening, or someone may be taking a person's ballot and voting for them. But we haven't had any proof that this has actually happened. I hope that the person will come in who got five ballots and sign an affidavit attesting to that, so that we can actually investigate. We've had people in our office that have contacted us to say, we don't know why we got a ballot. I said, sign an affidavit, come in, we'll get it notarized downstairs at the bank. We will investigate this for you. We will help you find out why you got a ballot. And in every case, that person decided not to, or declined to come in to sign an affidavit to the fact. So I think that, you know, we hear about this, but I know that the Lieutenant Governor's done a fairly good job with the ballot measure 2 recount. I know that people up in Fairbanks, for instance, the folks that work our precincts, you probably know Cam Carlson, you know, lifelong Republican, Valerie Therrien, lifelong Democrat. They've worked those precincts for years and years and years, and most people do, and they are above reproach. I can't imagine a time where anybody would be challenged this way, and they're volunteers. They're working hard doing ballot security measures at the precinct level, and then over at the division level, at the regional offices. And I sat there and watched them as they were reviewing ballots with my Republican colleagues. And so I know that, you know, we're trying to solve a problem that I don't know that we even have a problem at this point. And I just need to have some more proof that there's some sort of problem that we're trying to address here. If it's just if the person who received five ballots wants to come in, testify, put it on record, I would love to hear that. If the person who's a foreign national who received a ballot actually voted and received that ballot and voted, well, they've done something illegal. If a person got a registration after their permanent fund dividend, they attest when they sign the PFD that this is where their mailing address is and this is where their physical address or where they're domiciled. And that address is the address that they use for the division of elections. And so the automatic voter registration should work in that case.
How many questions do we have so far, just so I can write them down? Because I'm trying to track if this
that was
is
more of
a question.
That was more of a statement, but I do have a couple. I do want to hear that there were a quote certain number of errors in this last election, and I'd like to hear what those errors were, if they were material or if they were in fact just difficult to read scribbles marks like that. I also want to hear a little bit more of the chain of custody situation and how that would work. That's more of a technical question, and it would help if the Lieutenant Governor were here for that.
We will try.
Okay, and just finally the message about the destruction of ballots at the precinct level. I don't know. I'm pretty sure that that's regulation, but my mother, I took her in for to do her ballot in the primary. She made an error. They use pens instead of pencils to erase now. So she marked the wrong thing by mistake. She tried to scribble over it and decided it wasn't going to work. So what they do is they tear the ballot in half, they put it in an envelope, and they certify the envelope, seal it, and then that goes to Division of Elections. So they always know, and the ballots are all sequenced because they come to the precinct level in series, and they count them up at the division level, at the state level, division level, and then over at the precinct level. So they know, they account for every ballot as it goes through, whether it's destroyed, whether it's not, but they have it physically at the Division of Elections. And I'm pretty sure that that's regulation and not just policy.
I think.
And if we could find that out, that would be great.
Okay. Did you get all those written down?
Yep.
Okay.
In regard to the destruction of ballots, we might have to have testimony from people that came in with the legal cases that came in during the Murkowski Miller time in Negyek, Westlake, District 40. So we got to pull those legal cases. But we were also confirmed when we had our conversation starting 2 years ago that that can be a process used in the villages, and there's a way that they account for it in rural areas. So we've had those conversations with the Division of Elections. We didn't investigate fraud when we talked about this process. So that fraud claim has come up from people other than us. We've been talking about errors. And yes, fraud can happen, but to us it was a result of having errors. You leave things open, those kinds of things can happen. And it doesn't matter, going to the integrity of the individuals, we're not questioning individuals' integrity. Processes and systems, if you have a highly reliable process, especially I'm coming from a state trooper, if my training to use a weapon is highly refined, the process of doing that over and over, drawing that weapon out, is flawless, right? After time, should be. You should learn that muscle memory. You have a good process. They teach you a certain way. You're reducing the error rate in that. If you don't have a refined system, when a bad situation does happen, you're fumbling around and you're slower than the other guy and something bad can happen. We have to have processes that are flawless in this election system. It doesn't matter how many times you recount and recount and recount. If the quality of the ballots coming in is poor, you're going to have a bad recount, and it doesn't matter how many times you audit it. If you had a break in chain of custody and 200 ballots came into an election, it doesn't matter how many times you stare and look at the ballots. If you don't have a way to disseminate the bad ones from the good ones, you are not going to get an accurate count for the right reasons. So what I'm saying is when we see recounts, you want to pull your hair out, because recounts don't – that's just making sure that the tabulation of the ballots you have in hand, it doesn't go to the quality of it. And audits, election audits, aren't that different than recounts when you look at them. But some systems around the country are going to a different way to audit. And what do you do when you audit in a particularly different way? And how does that, being a data guy, how does that lead you to something?
Speak of Anchorage, by the way, versus the state when it comes to forensic signatures.
So one area that it just is shocking to me is the state, we were told by Division of Elections, they can't validate signatures. Unless you'd have to do it manually. But if you give me a signature as a state trooper and you tell me to match it and I go sit in front of a judge, he's going to ask what my expertise is in that. Have I been trained in signature validation for using a court to administer that to say somebody fraudulently did something? I've seen it tried by law enforcement. They're not allowed to do that. So if you have a layman just trying to compare signatures and something looks really good, how are they going to catch it without professional training? So we were told, though, that no matter if you have signatures on state ballots, we don't and can't do that. But the municipality of Anchorage does. They have a software program that does it. And Juneau, the city of Juneau, contracts them to do that with their ballots, signature verification, so they can scan them in and check them out. Why doesn't the state do that? It's at least higher level of scrutiny than what we're doing now. That's at least an additional level of verification, and we should be looking at that. So that's just one way of doing that. The testimony, yes. When I hear statements made, there was no evidence. We had a data breach. 113,000 records were stolen. That is evidence. We should have been told about it. This bill says you will tell us. The legislature at a minimum should have been told. Candidates at a minimum should have been told, because they would have taken a different level of vigilance the 5 days leading up to the election. So we have spoken, and we have turned many things over to law enforcement. And they are the ones in the appropriate agency to look in to see if things are criminal, if there's something nefarious. They have the resources, the angles, and those kinds of things. We can do so much. We can bring people in that can testify and say we've seen these. But to claim there is no evidence that there was an irregularity or an error is wrong. When somebody says, I got five ballots, and they've called our office, I don't have a tendency not to believe them. Just like if someone called your office and said, I didn't get it. I got one ballot. You're going to believe them. But we didn't just get one person telling us this. We got hundreds of people. And they weren't from our district. They were from your district, from Senator Costello's district, from Senator Reinbold's district. They were coming in from all over the state. And so we're trying to get out to those people. We've turned some of that information over, the ones that we felt rose to a level that was a little bit more than what we were prepared to work with. And I think it's really important that we stay away from there was none, there's no evidence, because I've heard that same claim from the Division of Elections. There's no evidence of it. Well, we have people that right now are saying we're willing to testify, and they're willing to come in and speak, and they're willing to sign affidavits. And I think that that's important, that we trust what our Alaskans are going to say. And just because we don't see something, we're blind to it, or we just weren't around it, doesn't mean it didn't happen. We need to listen to those stories. And I'm coming from a law enforcement background. Yes, I want to see, I want to hear. But not everything is physical proof. A lot of things are based on circumstantial. We have a lot of circumstances. Like with this election system, we have a lot of circumstances that raise into question the integrity of the election. I'm not saying it overturns anything. It changes the outcome of anything. But we have a lot of things that we're pointing to. This bill sort of highlights that. And when you start doing that, you start to question the whole system we have. And we have a lot of great people that are working inside the Division of Elections. I mean, we were very impressed working with the director and her staff going through the facilities here in Juneau, looking at the processes, looking at the equipment. And we had no issue with with that. But we raised a lot of questions. How's this done? How's that done? And then walking us through that. But it's through that investigation and through that inquiry that we're finding out that there are holes in our system that are creating more questions. And so I hope I answered some
you
of
did.
That.
Let me add a couple things real quick to that. And I would ask all the committee as well, Senator Kawasaki too, all of us, if you have questions, we're trying to write them, but make sure we get them right. If you have these lists of them, please fire them to us. We will do everything that we can to get all the answers, because that's part of this. We need to have this discussion. I want to get them out there. But so give us your questions, please, and written would help. We started this process, like I said, almost 3 years ago. I keep saying it because I want people not to understand this wasn't something that was the genesis was not this last election. We're using the past to inform how we might make the future better. That stuff is in the past. We're not interested in that to the extent that it informs us areas that we might be able to improve. But this whole thing started about error and process. The fraud discussion didn't even really come into this probably until after the August primary, where we started getting people calling, including my wife. And I would ask her to testify, but I don't know if I would do that without getting myself in big trouble, so I probably won't. But since she's watching this, we will certainly ask others. And to that final point, every single person we talked to, as we got further into calling people and asking them these specific questions, every single one of them said that they would be willing to testify, to talk to a law enforcement officer, to witness, signature, whatever they wanted to do. Almost none of them had pictures or anything, and that's why I circle back to it's unfortunate that this administration did not inform people so they could have been more vigilant about the things that were happening with the data breach, et cetera. So just for what it's worth, I'd like to continue on. And Mr. Ogan, did you have a comment? It sounded like you might have. That I'll get
you
back.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, I just wanted to point out how the legislature's own ethics statute requires that we avoid even the appearance of something unethical, even if it is ethical. And, you know, that's probably, you know, there's certainly perceptions by, I think, a significant number of voters that there was something fishy going on. And, you know, and I think it behooves us to create a most robust system of chain of custody. And I worked with chain of custody myself because when we had litigation, we had evidence that was subject to discovery, and we had strict chain of custody protocol. So I've got some experience with it myself. But I think if we design a really robust system, my goal, my hope is that we can create a system that will be a shining light on the hill for the rest of the states to look and go, wow, you know, Alaska got it right. And that's got to be a system that both sides of the aisle can go, yeah, this is good. This is going to protect, you know, my, you know, the people in my party that are running. This is going to protect people in the other party that are going to run. And most importantly, it's going to protect the integrity of the people that are out. You know, in our country, we don't have to pick up guns and put holes in each other. We used to put holes in ballots, you know. Now we fill in little ovals. That's a wondrous thing. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ernest. Senator Ramboll, do you have a question or comment?
Okay, so just a couple things. I don't. We have like a minute left or so. But just the black markers. I was given a one of these, and it didn't raise a red flag for me at all. I just went and voted, you know, in person. But some people were asking questions, and I actually couldn't answer the question, you know, in regards to is there a difference between markers and pens. So, I mean, maybe Division of Elections, when they come, can answer that. Another one is Judge Crosby. She struck down, in my opinion, a legitimate law. And I think it happened in multiple states, and it could have impacted the elections one way or another. So I think either having, you know, I'm a big believer in checks and balances and separation of powers, but there's also, you know, checks and balances that we need to look into. So I think looking into that decision, either having, you know, somebody from the courts, you know, able to come, or it could potentially have to be in judiciary. But I think that it's a worthy discussion to have in regards to what happened there, because I did talk to the Lieutenant Governor, and he did appeal it, and I was actually not following it that closely, and it was a good discussion that they really did try, and he even has unanswered questions that I think need to be answered in regards to that. And I think that we need to try to ensure that there's not political bias in the courts to the best of our ability as well. I'm not saying there is, and I'm not saying there isn't, but I'm saying, you know, there needs to be something looking into the potential, even in this piece of legislation, in regards to that. And I also wanted to mention that you said you were turning some things into the feds or something. I'm not exactly sure if I heard that right, but there were federal people on this ballot. So, I, you know, maybe it is an appropriate thing to do is because there are state and federal issues, you know, on the ballot. So that was actually intriguing. I had not heard that before, that they, but it could be definitely an applicable place to go.
Okay. And with that, since we are 5 o'clock and 38 seconds, two things. First, a thanks to the committee for indulging. That was long, and I apologize for that, but I knew this is a contentious bill. It's built up over the week. I thought it might be helpful if we get all this out front now so we can talk about it, and then we can have the debate. We'll get the testifiers. We'll get the questions and answer them, and we'll move through this as quickly but as prudently as we can. So thanks for your indulgence. Also, for me sitting here versus there, I thought with the flow and doing this today was a little bit different, kind of odd for me to not be sitting down there, but I thought this might just work better. So I hope that was okay with you and worked out well. So let me get back to the script here. So I say it right for the record, so I'll get in trouble if I can get back to it. Okay, at this time, we'll now set aside this bill. Next week, we will hear SB 25, State Government Finances, Website, and SB 43, Elections, Voting, Campaign Finance on Tuesday. On Thursday, we will hear SJR 5, Constitutional Amendment, Appropriation Limit, Budget, Reserve, SJR 6, Constitutional Amendment, Permanent Fund, and PFDs. SJR 7, Constitutional Amendment State Tax Voter Approval, and SB 53, Permanent Fund Advisory Vote. Seeing no further business for the committee at this time, we'll now adjourn at 501. We're done. Thank you.